Find algorithmic enhancements is also possible, but perhaps less likely. Software improvements, whether in algorithms or content, might offer orders of magnitude of potential performance gains that could be fairly easily accessed once a digital mind attains human parity, on top of the performance gains attainable by using more or better hardware. Optimization power and explosivity. Having examined the question of recalcitrance, we must now turn to the other half of our schematic equation. Optimization power. To recall, rate of change in intelligence equals optimization power over recalcitrance. As reflected in this schematic, a fast takeoff does not require that recalcitrance during the transition phase be low. A fast takeoff could also result if recalcitrance is constant or even moderately increasing, provided the optimization power being applied to improving the system's performance grows sufficiently rapidly. As we shall now see, there are good grounds for thinking that the applied optimization power will increase during the transition, at least in the absence of deliberate measures to prevent this from happening. We can distinguish two phases. The first phase begins with the onset of the takeoff, when the system reaches the human baseline for individual intelligence. As the system's capability continues to increase, it might use some or all of that capability to improve itself, or to design a successor system, which, for present purposes, comes to the same thing. However, most of the optimization power applied to the system still comes from outside the system, either from the work of programmers and engineers employed within the project, or from such work done by the rest of the world as can be appropriated and used by the project. If this phase drags out for any significant period of time, we can expect the amount of optimization power applied to the system to grow. Inputs, both from inside the project and from the outside world, are likely to increase as the promise of the chosen approach becomes manifest. Researchers may work harder, more researchers may be recruited, and more computing power may be purchased to expedite progress. The increase could be especially dramatic if the development of human-level machine intelligence takes the world by surprise, in which case, what was previously a small research project might suddenly become the focus of intense research and development efforts around the world, though some of those efforts might be channeled into competing projects. A second growth phase will begin if at some point the system has acquired so much capability that most of the optimization power exerted on it comes from the system itself, marked by the variable level labeled crossover in Figure 7. This fundamentally changes the dynamic, because any increase in the system's capability now translates into a proportional increase in the amount of optimization power being applied to its further improvement. If recalcitrance remains constant, this feedback dynamic produces exponential growth. See Box 4. The doubling constant depends on the scenario, but might be extremely short, mere seconds in some scenarios, if growth is occurring at electronic speeds, which might happen as a result of algorithmic improvements or the exploitation of an overhang of content or hardware. Growth that is driven by physical construction, such as the production of new computers or manufacturing equipment, would require a somewhat longer timescale, but still one that might be very short compared with the current growth rate of the world economy. It is thus likely that the applied optimization power will increase during the transition. Initially, because humans try harder to improve a machine intelligence that is showing spectacular promise. Later, because the machine intelligence itself becomes capable of driving further progress at digital speeds. This would create a real possibility of a fast or medium takeoff even if recalcitrance were constant or slightly increasing around the human baseline. Yet we saw in the previous subsection that there are factors that could lead to a big drop in recalcitrance around the human baseline level of capability. These factors include, for example, the possibility of rapid hardware expansion once a working software mind has been attained, the possibility of algorithmic improvements, the possibility of scanning additional brains in the case of whole-brain emulation, and the possibility of rapidly incorporating vast amounts of content by digesting the internet, in the case of artificial intelligence. These observations notwithstanding, the shape of the recalcitrance curve in the relevant region is not yet well characterized. In particular, it is unclear how difficult it would be to improve the software quality of a human-level emulation, or AI. The difficulty of expanding the hardware power available to a system is also not clear. Whereas today, it would be relatively easy to increase the computing power available to a small project by spending 1,000 times more on computing power, or by waiting a few years for the price of computers to fall, it is possible that the first machine intelligence to reach the human baseline will result from a large project involving pricey supercomputers, which cannot be cheaply scaled, and that Moore's law will by then have expired. For these reasons, although a fast or medium takeoff looks more likely, the possibility of a slow takeoff cannot be excluded. Box 4. On the kinetics of an intelligence explosion. We can write the rate of change in intelligence as the ratio between the optimization power applied to the system and the system's recalcitrance. Di over dt equals optimization over recalcitrance. The amount of optimization power acting on a system is the sum of whatever optimization power the system itself contributes and the optimization power exerted from without. For example, a seed AI might be improved through a combination of its own efforts and the efforts of a human programming team, and perhaps also the efforts of the wider global community of researchers making continuous advances in the semiconductor industry, computer science, and related fields. Optimization equals optimization system plus optimization project plus optimization world. A seed AI starts out with very limited cognitive capacities. At the outset, therefore, optimization system is small. What about optimization project and optimization world? There are cases in which a single project has more relevant capability than the rest of the world combined. The Manhattan Project, for instance, brought a very large fraction of the world's best physicists to Los Alamos to work on the atomic bomb. More commonly, any one project contains only a small fraction of the world's total relevant research capability. But even when the outside world has a greater total amount of relevant research capability than any one project, optimization project may nevertheless exceed optimization world, since much of the outside world's capability is not to be focused on the particular system in question. If a project begins to look promising, which will happen when a system passes the human baseline if not before, it might attract additional investment, increasing optimization project. If the project's accomplishments are public, optimization world might also rise as the progress inspires greater interest in machine intelligence generally, and as various powers scramble to get in on the game. During the transition phase, therefore, total optimization power applied to improving a cognitive system is likely to increase as the capability of the system increases. As the system's capabilities grow, there may come a point at which the optimization power generated by the system itself starts to dominate the optimization power applied to it from outside, across all significant dimensions of improvement. Optimization system is greater than optimization project plus optimization world. This crossover is significant because beyond this point, further improvement of the system's capabilities contributes strongly to increasing the total optimization power applied to improving the system. We thereby enter a regime of strong recursive self-improvement. This leads to explosive growth of the system's capability under a fairly wide range of different shapes of the recalcitrance curve. To illustrate, consider first a scenario in which recalcitrance is constant, so that the rate of increase in an AI's intelligence is equal to the optimization power being applied. Assume that all the optimization power that is applied comes from the AI itself and that the AI applies all its intelligence to the task of amplifying its own intelligence, so that optimization system equals I to the power of 22. We then have DI over DT equals I over K. Solving this simple differential equation yields the exponential function I equals AE to the power of T slash K. But recalcitrance being constant is a rather special case. Recalcitrance might well decline around the human baseline due to one or more of the factors mentioned in the previous subsection and remain low around the crossover and some distance beyond, perhaps until the system eventually approaches fundamental physical limits. For example, suppose that the optimization power applied to the system is roughly constant, i.e., optimization project plus optimization world is approximately equal to C, prior to the system becoming capable of contributing substantially to its own design, and that this leads to the system doubling in capacity every 18 months. This would be roughly in line with historical improvement rates from Moore's law combined with software advances. This rate of improvement, if achieved by means of roughly constant optimization power, entails recalcitrance declining as the inverse of the system power. DI over DT equals C over 1 slash I equals CI. If recalcitrance continues to fall along this hyperbolic pattern, then when the AI reaches the crossover point, the total amount of optimization power applied to improving the AI has doubled. We then have DI over DT equals brackets C plus I over 1 slash I equals brackets C plus I close brackets I. The next doubling occurs 7.5 months later. Within 17.9 months, the system's capacity has grown 1,000-fold, thus obtaining speed superintelligence, figure 9. This particular growth trajectory has a positive singularity at T equals 18 months. In reality, the assumption that recalcitrance is constant would cease to hold as the system began to approach the physical limits to information processing, if not sooner. These two scenarios are intended for illustration only. Many other trajectories are possible, depending on the shape of the recalcitrance curve. The claim is simply that the strong feedback loop that sets in around the crossover point tends strongly to make the takeoff faster than it would otherwise have been. Chapter 5. Decisive Strategic Advantage. A question distinct from, but related to, the question of kinetics is whether there will be one superintelligent power, or many. Might an intelligence explosion propel one project so far ahead of all others as to make it able to dictate the future? Or will progress be more uniform, unfurling across a wide front, with many projects participating, but none securing an overwhelming and permanent lead? The preceding chapter analyzed one key parameter in determining the size of the gap that might plausibly open up between a leading power and its nearest competitors, namely, the speed of the transition from human to strongly superhuman intelligence. This suggests a first-cut analysis. If the takeoff is fast, completed over the course of hours, days, or weeks, then it is unlikely that two independent projects would be taking off concurrently. Almost certainly, the first project would have completed its takeoff before any other project would have started its own. If the takeoff is slow, stretching over many years or decades, then there could plausibly be multiple projects undergoing takeoffs concurrently, so that although the projects would, by the end of the transition, have gained enormously in capability, there would be no time at which any project was far enough ahead of the others to give it an overwhelming lead. A takeoff of moderate speed is poised in between, with either condition a possibility. There might or might not be more than one project undergoing the takeoff at the same time. Will one machine intelligence project get so far ahead of the competition that it gets a decisive strategic advantage. That is, a level of technological and other advantages sufficient to enable it to achieve complete world domination. If a project did obtain a decisive strategic advantage, would it use it to suppress competitors and form a singleton, a world order in which there is, at the global level, a single decision-making agency? And if there is a winning project, how large would it be? Not in terms of physical size or budget, but in terms of how many people's desires would be controlling its design. We will consider these questions in turn. Will the front runner get a decisive strategic advantage? One factor influencing the width of the gap between front runner and followers is the rate of diffusion of whatever it is that gives the leader a competitive advantage. A front runner might find it difficult to gain and maintain a large lead if followers can easily copy the front runner's ideas and innovations. Imitation creates a headwind that disadvantages the leader and benefits laggards, especially if intellectual property is weakly protected. A frontrunner might also be especially vulnerable to expropriation, taxation, or being broken up under anti-monopoly regulation. It would be a mistake, however, to assume that this headwind must increase monotonically with the gap between frontrunner and followers. Just as a racing cyclist who falls too far behind the competition is no longer shielded from the wind by the cyclists ahead, so a technology follower who lags sufficiently behind the cutting edge might find it hard to assimilate the advances being made at the frontier. The gap in understanding and capability might have grown too large. The leader might have migrated to a more advanced technology platform, making subsequent innovations untransferable to the primitive platforms used by laggards. A sufficiently preeminent leader might have the ability to stem information leakage from its research programs and its sensitive installations, or to sabotage its competitors' efforts to develop their own advanced capabilities. If the frontrunner is an AI system, it could have attributes that make it easier for it to expand its capabilities while reducing the rate of diffusion. In human-run organizations, economies of scale are counteracted by bureaucratic inefficiencies and agency problems, including difficulties in keeping trade secrets. These problems would presumably limit the growth of a machine intelligence project so long as it is operated by humans. An AI system, however, might avoid some of these scale diseconomies, since the AI's modules, in contrast to human workers, need not have individual preferences that diverge from those of the system as a whole. Thus, the AI system could avoid a sizable chunk of the inefficiencies arising from agency problems in human enterprises. The same advantage, having perfectly loyal parts, would also make it easier for an AI system to pursue long-range clandestine goals. An AI would have no disgruntled employees ready to be poached by competitors, or bribed into becoming informants. We can get a sense of the distribution of plausible gaps in development times by looking at some historical examples. See Box 5. It appears that lags in the range of a few months to a few years are typical of strategically significant technology projects. It is possible that globalization and increased surveillance will reduce typical lags between competing technology projects. Yet there is likely to be a lower bound on how short the average lag could become, in the absence of deliberate coordination. Even absent dynamics that lead to snowball effects, some projects will happen to end up with better research staff, leadership, and infrastructure, or will just stumble upon better ideas. If two projects pursue alternative approaches, one of which turns out to work better, it may take the rival project many months to switch to the superior approach, even if it is able to closely monitor what the forerunner is doing. Combining these observations with our earlier discussion of the speed of the takeoff, we can conclude that it is highly unlikely that two projects would be close enough to undergo a fast takeoff concurrently. For a medium takeoff, it could easily go either way. And for a slow takeoff, it is highly likely that several projects would undergo the process in parallel. but the analysis needs a further step. The key question is not how many projects undergo a takeoff in tandem, but how many projects emerge on the yonder side, sufficiently tightly clustered in capability, but none of them has a decisive strategic advantage. If the takeoff process is relatively slow to begin, and then gets faster, the distance between competing projects would tend to grow. To return to our bicycle metaphor, the situation would be analogous to a pair of cyclists making their way up a steep hill, one trailing some distance behind the other, the gap between them then expanding as the front runner reaches the peak and starts accelerating down the other side. Consider the following medium takeoff scenario. Suppose it takes a project 1 year to increase its AI's capability from the human baseline to a strong superintelligence, and that one project enters this takeoff phase with a 6-month lead over the next most advanced project. The two projects will be undergoing a takeoff concurrently. It might seem then that neither project gets a decisive strategic advantage, but that need not be so. Suppose it takes 9 months to advance from the human baseline to the crossover point, and another 3 months from there to strong superintelligence. The frontrunner then attains strong superintelligence 3 months before the following project even reaches the crossover point. This would give the leading project a decisive strategic advantage, and the opportunity to parlay its lead into permanent control by disabling the competing projects and establishing a singleton. Note that the concept of a singleton is an abstract one. A singleton could be democracy, a tyranny, a single dominant AI, a strong set of global norms that include effective provisions for their own enforcement, or even an alien overlord. Its defining characteristic being simply that it is some form of agency that can solve all major global coordination problems. It may, but need not resemble any familiar form of human governance. Since there is an especially strong prospect of explosive growth just after the crossover point, when the strong positive feedback loop of optimization power kicks in, a scenario of this kind is a serious possibility, and it increases the chances that the leading project will attain a decisive strategic advantage, even if the takeoff is not fast. Box 5. Technology races, some historical examples. Over long historical timescales, there has been an increase in the rate at which knowledge and technology diffuse around the globe. As a result, the temporal gaps between technology leaders and nearest followers have narrowed. China managed to maintain a monopoly on silk production for over 2,000 years. Archaeological finds suggest the production might have begun around 3000 BC, or even earlier. Sericulture was a closely held secret. Revealing the techniques was punishable by death, as was exporting silkworms or their eggs outside China. The Romans, despite the high price commanded by imported silk cloth in their empire, never learnt the art of silk manufacture. Not until around AD 300 did a Japanese expedition manage to capture some silkworm eggs, along with 4 young Chinese girls, who were forced to divulge the art to their abductors. Byzantium joined the club of producers in AD 522. The story of porcelain making also features long lags. The craft was practiced in China during the Tang Dynasty, around AD 600, and might have been in use as early as AD 200. But was mastered by Europeans only in the 18th century. Wheeled vehicles appeared in several sites across Europe and Mesopotamia around 3500 BC, but reached the Americas only in post-Columbian times. On a grander scale, the human species took tens of thousands of years to spread across most of the globe, the agricultural revolution thousands of years, the industrial revolution only hundreds of years, and an information revolution could be said to have spread globally over the course of decades, though of course these transitions are not necessarily of equal profundity. The Dance Dance Revolution video game spread from Japan to Europe and North America in just 1 year. Technological competition has been quite extensively studied, particularly in the contexts of patent races and arms races. It is beyond the scope of our investigation to review this literature here. However, it is instructive to look at some examples of strategically significant technology races in the 20th century. See Table 7. With regard to these six technologies, which were regarded as strategically important by the rivaling superpowers because of their military or symbolic significance, the gaps between leader and merest laggard were, very approximately, 49 months, 36 months, 4 months, 1 month, 4 months, and 60 months, respectively. Longer than the duration of a fast takeoff, and shorter than the duration of a slow takeoff. In many cases, the laggard's project benefited from espionage and publicly available information. The mere demonstration of the feasibility of an invention can also encourage others to develop it independently, and fear of falling behind can spur the efforts to catch up. Perhaps closer to the case of AI are mathematical inventions that do not require the development of new physical infrastructure. Often these are published in the academic literature and can thus be regarded as universally available. But in some cases, when the discovery appears to offer a strategic advantage, publication is delayed. For example, two of the most important ideas in public key cryptography are the Diffie-Hellman key exchange protocol and the RSA encryption scheme. These were discovered by the academic community in 1976 and 1978 respectively, but it has later been confirmed that they were known by cryptographers at the UK's Communications Security Group since the early 1970s. Large software projects might offer a closer analogy with AI projects, but it is harder to give crisp examples of typical lags because software is usually rolled out in incremental installments, and the functionalities of competing systems are often not directly comparable. How large will the successful project be? Some paths to superintelligence require great resources and are therefore likely to be the preserve of large, well-funded projects. Whole brain emulation, for instance, requires many different kinds of expertise and lots of equipment. Biological intelligence enhancements and brain-computer interfaces would also have a large-scale factor. While a small biotech firm might invent one or two drugs, achieving superintelligence along one of these paths, if doable at all, would likely require many inventions and many tests, and therefore the backing of an industrial sector or a well-funded national program. Achieving collective superintelligence by making organizations and networks more efficient requires even more extensive input, involving much of the world economy. An AI path is more difficult to assess. Perhaps it would require a very large research program. Perhaps it could be done by a small group. A lone hacker scenario cannot be excluded either. Building a seed AI might require insights and algorithms developed over many decades by the scientific community around the world. But it is possible that the last critical breakthrough idea might come from a single individual or a small group that succeeds in putting everything together. This scenario is less realistic for some AI architectures than others. A system that has a large number of parts that need to be tweaked and tuned to work effectively together, and then painstakingly loaded with custom-made cognitive content, is likely to require a larger project. But if a seed AI could be instantiated as a simple system, one whose construction depends only on getting a few basic principles right, then the feat might be within the reach of a small team or an individual. The likelihood of the final breakthrough being made by a small project increases if most previous progress in the field has been published in the open literature or made available as open source software. We must distinguish the question of how big will be the project that directly engineers the system from the question of how big the group will be that controls whether, how, and when the system is created. The atomic bomb was created primarily by a group of scientists and engineers, The Manhattan Project employed about 130,000 people at its peak, the vast majority of whom were construction workers or building operators. These technical experts, however, were controlled by the U.S. military, which was directed by the U.S. government, which was ultimately accountable to the American electorate, which, at the time, constituted about one-tenth of the adult world population. Monitoring. Given the extreme security implications of superintelligence, governments would likely seek to nationalize any project on their territory that they thought close to achieving a takeoff. A powerful state might also attempt to acquire projects located in other countries through espionage, theft, kidnapping, bribery, threats, military conquest, or any other available means. A powerful state that cannot acquire a foreign project might instead destroy it, especially if the host country lacks an effective deterrent. If global governance structures are strong by the time a breakthrough begins to look imminent, it is possible that promising projects would be placed under international control. An important question, therefore, is whether national or international authorities will see an intelligence explosion coming. At present, intelligence agencies do not appear to be looking very hard for promising AI projects or other forms of potentially explosive intelligence amplification, if they are indeed not paying much attention. This is presumably due to the widely shared perception that there is no prospect whatever of imminent superintelligence. If and when it becomes a common belief among prestigious scientists that there is a substantial chance that superintelligence is just around the corner, the major intelligence agencies of the world would probably start to monitor groups and individuals who seem to be engaged in relevant research. Any project that began to show sufficient progress could then be promptly nationalized. If political elites were persuaded by the seriousness of the risk, civilian efforts in sensitive areas might be regulated or outlawed. How difficult would such monitoring be? The task is easier if the goal is only to keep track of the leading project. In that case, surveillance focusing on the several best-resourced projects may be sufficient. If the goal is instead to prevent any work from taking place, at least outside of specially authorized institutions, then surveillance would have to be more comprehensive, since many small projects and individuals are in a position to make at least some progress. It would be easier to monitor projects that require significant amounts of physical capital, as would be the case with a whole brain emulation project. Artificial intelligence research, by contrast, requires only a personal computer, and would therefore be more difficult to monitor. Some of the theoretical work could be done with pen and paper. Even so, it would not be too difficult to identify most capable individuals with a serious long-standing interest in artificial general intelligence research. Such individuals usually leave visible trails. They may have published academic papers, presented at conferences, posted on internet forums, or earned degrees from leading computer science departments. They may also have had communications with other AI researchers, allowing them to be identified by mapping the social graph. Projects designed from the outset to be secret could be more difficult to detect. An ordinary software development project could serve as a front. Only careful analysis of the code being produced would reveal the true nature of what the project was trying to accomplish. Such analysis would require a lot of highly skilled manpower, whence only a small number of suspect projects could be scrutinized at this level. The task would become much easier if effective lie detection technology had been developed and could be routinely used in this kind of surveillance. Another reason states might fail to catch precursor developments is the inherent difficulty of forecasting some types of breakthrough. This is more relevant to AI research than to whole brain emulation development, since for the latter, the key breakthrough is more likely to be preceded by a clear gradient of steady advances. It is also possible that intelligence agencies and other government bureaucracies have a certain clumsiness or rigidity that might prevent them from understanding the significance of some developments that might be clear to some outside groups. Barriers to official understanding of a potential intelligence explosion might be especially steep. It is conceivable, for example, that the topic will become inflamed with religious or political controversies, rendering it taboo for officials in some countries. The topic might become associated with some discredited figure or with charlatanry and hype in general, hence shunned by respected scientists and other establishment figures. As we saw in Chapter 1, something like this has already happened twice. Recall the two AI winters. Industry groups might lobby to prevent aspersions being cast on profitable business areas. Academic communities might close ranks to marginalize those who voice concerns about long-term consequences of the science that is being done. Consequently, a total intelligence failure cannot be ruled out. Such a failure is especially likely if breakthroughs should occur in the nearer future, before the issue has risen to public prominence. And even if intelligence agencies get it right, political leaders might not listen or act on the advice. Getting the Manhattan Project started took an extraordinary effort by several visionary physicists, including especially Marc Oliphant and Leo Szilard. The latter persuaded Eugene Wigner to persuade Albert Einstein to put his name on a letter to persuade President Franklin D. Roosevelt to look into the matter. Even after the project reached its full scale, Roosevelt remained skeptical of its workability and significance, as did his successor, Harry Truman. For better or worse, it would probably be harder for a small group of activists to affect the outcome of an intelligence explosion if big players such as states are taking active part. Opportunities for private individuals to reduce the overall amount of existential risk from a potential intelligence explosion are therefore greatest in scenarios in which big players remain relatively oblivious to the issue, or in which the early efforts of activists make a major difference to whether, when, which, or with what attitude big players enter the game. Activists seeking maximum expected impact may therefore wish to focus most of their planning on such high-leverage scenarios, even if they believe that scenarios in which big players end up calling all the shots are more probable. International collaboration. International coordination is more likely if global governance structures generally get stronger. Coordination might also be more likely if the significance of an intelligence explosion is widely appreciated ahead of time, and if effective monitoring of all serious projects is feasible. Even if monitoring is infeasible, however, international cooperation would still be possible. Many countries could band together to support a joint project. If such a joint project were sufficiently well-resourced, it could have a good chance of being the first to reach the goal, especially if any rival project had to be small and secretive to elude detection. There are precedents of large-scale successful multinational scientific collaborations, such as the International Space Station, the Human Genome Project, and the Large Hadron Collider. However, the major motivation for collaboration in those cases was cost-sharing. In the case of the International Space Station, fostering a collaborative spirit between Russia and the United States was itself an important goal. Achieving similar collaboration on a project that has enormous security implications would be more difficult. A country that believed it could achieve a breakthrough unilaterally might be tempted to go it alone rather than subordinate its efforts to a joint project. A country might also refrain from joining an international collaboration from fear that other participants might siphon off collaboratively generated insights and use them to accelerate a covert national project. An international project would thus need to overcome major security challenges, and a fair amount of trust would probably be needed to get it started, trust that may take time to develop. Consider that even after the thaw in relations between the United States and the Soviet Union, following Gorbachev's ascent to power, arms reduction efforts, which could be greatly in the interests of both superpowers, had a fitful beginning. Gorbachev was seeking steep reductions in nuclear arms, but negotiations stalled on the issue of Reagan's Strategic Defense Initiative, Star Wars, which the Kremlin strenuously opposed. At the Reykjavik summit meeting in 1986, Reagan proposed that the United States would share with the Soviet Union the technology that would be developed under the Strategic Defense Initiative, so that both countries could enjoy protection against accidental launches and against smaller nations that might develop nuclear weapons. Yet Gorbachev was not persuaded by this apparent win-win proposition. He viewed the gambit as a ruse, refusing to credit the notion that the Americans would share the fruits of their most advanced military research at a time when they were not even willing to share with the Soviets their technology for milking cows. Regardless of whether Reagan was in fact sincere in his offer of superpower collaboration, mistrust made the proposal a non-starter. Collaboration is easier to achieve between allies, but even there it is not automatic. When the Soviet Union and the United States were allied against Germany during World War II, the United States concealed its atomic bomb project from the Soviet Union. The United States did collaborate on the Manhattan Project with Britain and Canada. Similarly, the United Kingdom concealed its success in breaking the German Enigma Code from the Soviet Union, but shared it, albeit with some difficulty, with the United States. This suggests that in order to achieve international collaboration on some technology that is of pivotal importance for national security, it might be necessary to have built beforehand a close and trusting relationship. We will return in Chapter 14 to the desirability and feasibility of international collaboration in the development of intelligence amplification technologies. From decisive strategic advantage to singleton. Would a project that obtained a decisive strategic advantage choose to use it to form a singleton? Consider a vaguely analogous historical situation. The United States developed nuclear weapons in 1945. It was the sole nuclear power until the Soviet Union developed the atom bomb in 1949. During this interval, and for some time thereafter, the United States may have had or been in a position to achieve a decisive military advantage. The United States could then theoretically have used its nuclear monopoly to create a singleton. One way in which it could have done so would have been by embarking on an all-out effort to build up its nuclear arsenal, and then threatening, and if necessary carrying out, a nuclear first strike to destroy the industrial capacity of any incipient nuclear program in the USSR and any other country tempted to develop a nuclear capability. A more benign course of action, which might also have had a chance of working, would have been to use its nuclear arsenal as a bargaining chip to negotiate a strong international government. A veto-less United Nations with a nuclear monopoly and a mandate to take all necessary actions to prevent any country from developing its own nuclear weapons. Both of these approaches were proposed at the time. The hardline approach of launching or threatening a first strike was advocated by some prominent intellectuals, such as Bertrand Russell, who had long been active in anti-war movements, and who would later spend decades campaigning against nuclear weapons, and John von Neumann, co-creator of game theory, and one of the architects of U.S. nuclear strategy. Perhaps it is a sign of civilizational progress that the very idea of threatening a nuclear first strike today seems borderline silly or morally obscene. A version of the benign approach was tried in 1946 by the United States in the form of the Baruch Plan. The proposal involved the USA giving up its temporary nuclear monopoly. Uranium and thorium mining and nuclear technology would be placed under the control of an international agency operating under the auspices of the United Nations. The proposal called for the permanent members of the Security Council to give up their vetoes in matters related to nuclear weapons in order to prevent any great power found to be in breach of the accord from vetoing the imposition of remedies. Stalin, seeing that the Soviet Union and its allies could be easily outvoted in both the Security Council and the General Assembly, rejected the proposal. A frosty atmosphere of mutual suspicion descended on the relations between the former wartime allies, mistrust that soon solidified into the Cold War. As had been widely predicted, a costly and extremely dangerous nuclear arms race followed. Many factors might dissuade a human organization with a decisive strategic advantage from creating a singleton. These include non-aggregative or bounded utility functions, non-maximizing decision rules, confusion and uncertainty, coordination problems, and various costs associated with the takeover. But what if it were not a human organization, but a superintelligent artificial agent that came into possession of a decisive strategic advantage? Would the aforementioned factors be equally effective at inhibiting an AI from attempting to seize power? Let us briefly run through the list of factors and consider how they might apply in this case. Human individuals and human organizations typically have preferences over resources that are not well represented by an unbounded, aggregative utility function. A human will typically not wager all her capital for a 50-50 chance of doubling it. A state will typically not risk losing all its territory for a 10% chance of a tenfold expansion. For individuals and governments, there are diminishing returns to most resources. The same need not hold for AIs. We will return to the problem of AI motivation in subsequent chapters. An AI might therefore be more likely to pursue a risky course of action that has some chances of giving it control of the world. Humans and human-run organizations may also operate with decision processes that do not seek to maximize expected utility. For example, they may allow for fundamental risk aversion or satisficing decision rules that focus on meeting adequacy thresholds or deontological side constraints that prescribe certain kinds of action regardless of how desirable their consequences. Human decision makers often seem to be acting out an identity or a social role rather than seeking to maximize the achievement of some particular objective. Again, this need not apply to artificial agents. Bounded utility functions, risk aversion, and non-maximizing decision rules may combine synergistically with strategic confusion and uncertainty. Revolutions, even when they succeed in overthrowing the existing order, often fail to produce the outcome that their instigators had promised. This tends to stay the hand of a human agent if the contemplated action is irreversible, norm-breaking, and lacking precedent. A superintelligence might perceive the situation more clearly and therefore face less strategic confusion and uncertainty about the outcome should it attempt to use its apparent decisive strategic advantage to consolidate its dominant position. Another major factor that can inhibit groups from exploiting a potentially decisive strategic advantage is the problem of internal coordination. Members of a conspiracy that is in a position to seize power must worry not only about being infiltrated from the outside, but also about being overthrown by some smaller coalition of insiders. If a group consists of 100 people, and a majority of 60 can take power and disenfranchise the non-conspirators, what is then to stop a 35-strong subset of these 60 from disenfranchising the other 25, and then maybe a subset of 20 disenfranchising the other 15? Each of the original 100 might have good reason to uphold certain established norms to prevent the general unraveling that could result from any attempt to change the social contract by means of a naked power grab. This problem of internal coordination would not apply to an AI system that constitutes a single unified agent. Finally, there is the issue of cost. Even if the United States could have used its nuclear monopoly to establish a singleton, it might not have been able to do so without incurring substantial costs. In the case of a negotiated agreement to place nuclear weapons under the control of a reformed and strengthened United Nations, these costs might have been relatively small. But the costs, moral, economic, political, and human, of actually attempting world conquest through the waging of nuclear war would have been almost unthinkably large, even during the period of nuclear monopoly. With sufficient technological superiority, however, these costs would be far smaller. Consider, for example, a scenario in which one nation had such a vast technological lead that it could safely disarm all other nations at the press of a button, without anybody dying or being injured, and with almost no damage to infrastructure or to the environment. With such almost magical technological superiority, a first strike would be a lot more tempting. Or consider an even greater level of technological superiority, which might enable the frontrunner to cause other nations to voluntarily lay down their arms, not by threatening them with destruction, but simply by persuading a great majority of their populations, by means of an extremely effectively designed advertising and propaganda campaign, extolling the virtues of global unity. If this were done with the intention to benefit everybody, for instance by replacing national rivalries and arms races with a fair, representative, and effective world government, it is not clear that there would be even a cogent moral objection to the leveraging of a temporary strategic advantage into a permanent singleton. Various considerations thus point to an increased likelihood that a future power with superintelligence that obtained a sufficiently large strategic advantage would actually use it to form a singleton. The desirability of such an outcome depends, of course, on the nature of the singleton that would be created, and also on what the future of intelligent life would look like in alternative multipolar scenarios. We will revisit those questions in later chapters. But first, let us take a closer look at why and how a superintelligence would be powerful and effective at achieving outcomes in the world. Chapter 6. Cognitive Superpowers. Suppose that a digital superintelligent agent came into being, and that for some reason it wanted to take control of the world. Would it be able to do so? In this chapter, we consider some powers that a superintelligence could develop, and what they may enable it to do. We outline a takeover scenario that illustrates how a superintelligent agent, starting as mere software, could establish itself as a singleton. We also offer some remarks on the relation between power over nature and power over other agents. The principal reason for humanity's dominant position on Earth is that our brains have a slightly expanded set of faculties compared with other animals. Our greater intelligence lets us transmit culture more efficiently, with the result that knowledge and technology accumulates from one generation to the next. By now, sufficient content has accumulated to make possible spaceflight, H-bombs, genetic engineering, computers, factory farms, insecticides, the international peace movement, and all the accoutrements of modern civilization. Geologists have started referring to the present era as the Anthropocene, in recognition of the distinctive biotic, sedimentary, and geochemical signatures of human activities. On one estimate, we appropriate 24% of the planetary ecosystem's net primary production, and yet, we are far from having reached the physical limits of technology. These observations make it plausible that any type of entity that developed a much greater than human level of intelligence would be potentially extremely powerful. Such entities could accumulate content much faster than us and invent new technologies on a much shorter timescale. They could also use their intelligence to strategize more effectively than we can. Let us consider some of the capabilities that a superintelligence could have and how it could use them. Functionalities and superpowers. It is important not to anthropomorphize superintelligence when thinking about its potential impacts. Anthropomorphic frames encourage unfounded expectations about the growth trajectory of a seed AI and about the psychology, motivations, and capabilities of a mature superintelligence. For example, a common assumption is that a superintelligent machine would be like a very clever but nerdy human being. We imagine that the AI has book smarts, but lacks social savvy, or that it is logical, but not intuitive and creative. This idea probably originates in observation. We look at present-day computers and see that they are good at calculation, remembering facts, and at following the letter of instructions, while being oblivious to social contexts and subtexts, norms, emotions, and politics. The association is strengthened when we observe that the people who are good at working with computers tend themselves to be nerds. So it is natural to assume that more advanced computational intelligence will have similar attributes, only to a higher degree. This heuristic might retain some validity in the early stages of development of a seed AI. There is no reason whatever to suppose that it would apply to emulations or to cognitively enhanced humans. In its immature stage, what is later to become a superintelligent AI might still lack many skills and talents that come naturally to a human. And the pattern of such a seed AI's strengths and weaknesses might indeed bear some vague resemblance to an IQ nerd. The most essential characteristic of a seed AI, aside from being easy to improve, having low recalcitrance, is being good at exerting optimization power to amplify a system's intelligence, a skill which is presumably closely related to doing well in mathematics, programming, engineering, computer science research, and other such nerdy pursuits. However, even if a seed AI does have such a nerdy capability profile at one stage of its development, this does not entail that it will grow into a similarly limited, mature superintelligence. Recall the distinction between direct and indirect reach. With sufficient skill at intelligence amplification, all other intellectual abilities are within a system's indirect reach. The system can develop new cognitive modules and skills as needed, including empathy, political acumen, and any other powers stereotypically wanting in computer-like personalities. Even if we recognize that a superintelligence can have all the skills and talents we find in the human distribution, along with other talents that are not found among humans, the tendency toward anthropomorphizing can still lead us to underestimate the extent to which a machine superintelligence could exceed the human level of performance. Eliza Yudkowsky, as we saw in an earlier chapter, has been particularly emphatic in condemning this kind of misconception. Our intuitive concepts of smart and stupid are distilled from our experience of variation over the range of human thinkers. Yet the differences in cognitive ability within this human cluster are trivial in comparison to the differences between any human intellect and a superintelligence. Chapter 3 reviewed some of the potential sources of advantage for machine intelligence. The magnitudes of the advantages are such as to suggest that rather than thinking of a superintelligent AI as smart, in the sense that a scientific genius is smart compared with the average human being, it might be closer to the mark to think of such an AI as smart in the sense that an average human being is smart compared with a beetle or a worm. It would be convenient if we could quantify the cognitive caliber of an arbitrary cognitive system using some familiar metric, such as IQ scores or some version of the ELO ratings that measure the relative abilities of players in two-player games, such as chess. But these metrics are not useful in the context of superhuman artificial general intelligence. We are not interested in how likely a superintelligence is to win at a game of chess. As for IQ scores, they are informative only insofar as we have some idea of how they correlate with practically relevant outcomes. For example, we have data that show that people with an IQ of 130 are more likely than those with an IQ of 90 to excel in school and to do well in a wide range of cognitively demanding jobs. But suppose we could somehow establish that a certain future AI will have an IQ of 6,455. Then what? We would have no idea of what such an AI could actually do. We would not even know that such an AI had as much general intelligence as a normal human adult. Perhaps the AI would instead have a bundle of special purpose algorithms, enabling it to solve typical intelligence test questions with superhuman efficiency, but not much else. Some recent efforts have been made to develop measurements of cognitive capacity that could be applied to a wider range of information processing systems, including artificial intelligences. Work in this direction, if it can overcome various technical difficulties,